Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and hashtag #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, everybody. This is your host, Daria Ann. I want to welcome you to Right Stream Tuesday. It's very nice to be here again after a week off, but I'll tell you, I really did enjoy my visit last week with my mom and my brother Ralph. We had a great time, and I so appreciate my guest host, Diane Student, filling in for me last week. For those of you who don't know, Diane is a very seasoned internet, award-winning actually, internet radio host who had her own show for several years called Freedom's Wings. And last week she filled in for me at a special time of 6 p.m. and interviewed a really exceptional author named Bruce Hennigan. And the interview was about his book, The 12th Demon. And I listened to the archive the other day, and it was just a phenomenal interview. So if you missed it, please go back and check the archives here, and you can listen to all of our shows, obviously, at blogtalkradio.com/rightstream, and find out about our lineup of hosts and shows at our website, rightstreamradio.com. I set up this network in March of 2013 to cater to a lot of different tastes, so not every show is going to be everybody's cup of tea, just as not every Right Stream Tuesday is going to be everybody's cup of tea, because I interview authors in a variety of genres, even the ones that I don't particularly read or care for, because I just love the creative process. I love to celebrate the talent that's out there, and especially the talent that we're seeing now with independent authors who have taken advantage of all of these great new technology tools we have to bypass the gatekeepers at the old-time publishing companies and really find our readers and our market and our fellow writers in cyberspace. So please, again, you can visit rightstreamradio.com for our full lineup of shows and hosts, and I really encourage you to do that because we're doing our best to provide some good quality programming, excellent guests, and some good information for our listeners. So speaking of which, I have a returning guest today, one of my favorites, my buddy Declan Finn. He is the author of The Pious Trilogy, and you may remember last year I reviewed his book, A Pious Man, A Holy Thriller, which I finally had. I finally have the review going up on Amazon, my gosh, after over a year. But I did review it on my blog, and that was when I initially brought Declan onto the show. And he's a man of many talents. He's got a lot of great news to share with us today about a contract that he just received, and I'm not going to steal his thunder. I want him to tell us about it. But for those of you who don't know him, I'm just going to read his brief bio from the AmericanJournal.com website, where he is a contributor, as am I. And if you haven't checked that out, I highly recommend it. It's theamericanjournal.com, but it's the-american-journal.com. So Declan's bio, short bio there reads, Declan Finn is an author of four novels, only three of which are interesting. Well, I would beg to differ with that, but including A Pious Man, A Holy Thriller, A Pious Legacy, A Political Thriller, and the co-author of the science fiction espionage thriller, Codename Winterborn. And here's where it gets interesting, and I've got to talk to him about this today. Codename Winterborn is set in 2093, where a team of American intelligence officers are betrayed by politicians and left to die in the radical Islamic Republic of France. Yes, it was written before anyone had heard of Benghazi. You know, and in light of recent events with this new investigation that we're finally going to have with the release of emails that Judicial Watch, an outside organization, had to actually sue for to finally get released, Codename Winterborn is more relevant than ever. So without further ado, I want to welcome author Declan Finn to the program. Hey, Declan.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always great to have you back. I love you probably, were probably laughing to yourself as I was rambling on, but, my interview style with these particular shows is very casual and conversational, and you're one of my favorite guests because, you kind of go with that flow, and it's just a pleasure to chat with you on the air. So tell us, for anybody that doesn't know you, Declan, I know I just read your short bio. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into some of these topics.
Well, let me see. I've been writing for since I've been 16, and I'm currently 32, if anyone's doing the math. I've pretty much started doing what is now called fan fiction. It turned into something completely original and different, and then I realized I can't stop writing. So that's pretty much how that got started. I'm decidedly overeducated in completely worthless topics, or at least worthless by market standards. Went into a master's degree in history. I had to run fleeing from a PhD in history, but that's another story. But some good has come out of it. The entire Pius trilogy, for one, actually started from a master's paper that seriously got out of hand. Basically, I have these academic version of Hulk smash moments, and they turn into books. So there's that one. I currently study Krav Maga, which is the self-defense system of the Israeli military. Thankfully, the civilian version is the one that has the fewest rules, because, Krav Maga for cops involves you have to cuff them. Sometimes that even goes for the Israeli military because they want to interrogate some of these guys. And for civilians, at least in states other than New York, they pulled a knife on you. You can now return it to him into his chest cavity. But, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's something I've been wanting to learn, Krav Maga.
You're going to enjoy it.
I've been after, not to go in another direction here, I'll just say this really quickly, but my client, whose book I just wrote in, you know, in collaboration with him, but it was ghostwritten. He's from Israel, and he knows Krav Maga, and I bug him all the time to teach me, but he's so busy, we haven't had time to get around to it.
Well, but if I wasn't on the other end of the East Coast, I'd teach you a few things.
But, so Declan, recently, though, you had, you know, I want to get in and talk about some of your books, and then I want to talk about, you know, your contributions to American Journal, because you've really, in the last couple of weeks, you've posted some excellent commentary there on current events. But I want to start with, tell us about Honor at Stake, because you had some really exciting news with this book, and you wrote that several years ago, correct?
Yes, it did. I'm trying to figure out if it's 5 years or 10 years. It all starts to blur after a while. The short version, Honor at Stake, is a vampire novel I had written because I got tired of sparkly vampires. I got tired of the porn that was Laurel K. Hamilton and Anne Rice. And, you know, figured around with it. It really wasn't, by my standards, a serious project. Because, you know, I tapped it out. I think it's my shortest book at 96,000 words. But anyway, I was going through one of the Facebook groups. I believe it was the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance. I think I got the order right.
You did. Very good.
Okay. Where one of the members said, "Hi, I'm an acquisition editor for a publishing company. I have nothing in my inbox. I am bored. Somebody send me something." So I did. And within 6 hours of her sending me a confirmation email, the follow-up email was, "Okay, I finished it. You'll get a contract in the mail in a few days." It's like, pause.
Wow.
Wait, what? So that was one of the more interesting experiences of my life. Sorry for stuttering and sputtering a bit, but it's one of those moments of, wait, I sent out easily hundreds of query letters to all those agents and publishers. I've had God knows how many reams of paper sacrificed to the gods of first drafts or queries, and it was that easy?
Had you independently published this Honor at Stake, or was it just one of those you had written back in the days when we still had to go through the gatekeepers? And
it was written back in the day. It was actually going to be one of the next books after I was done with the Pius trilogy, since A Pious Sand is going to be out in, like, hopefully the next 3 months. Fingers crossed. I'm waiting on beta readers. But, no, it was never self-published. In fact, the publisher will not take previously published manuscripts unless it's something that already hit big on its own. The publisher, by the way, is Damnation Books, part of Eternal Press. So I'm a Catholic writer who now works for Eternal Damnation. Insert your own joke here.
Oh, I think I just did. Well, you know, somehow it seems like it all sort of, I don't know, kind of fitting. It's kind of relates. You know, Declan, we have a caller on the switchboard, and I know we're kind of early on into the show, and I usually wait, but I don't want this person to keep holding. And since I don't have a way to screen, I don't have a producer, it'll be a surprise for both of us.
Okay. Sure, go ahead.
You're up for it. Okay, so caller from the 219 area code, you are live on Right Stream Tuesday.
Hello.
Hello.
This is, call me Margo.
Hello.
I'm sorry. What is your first name again?
Actually, I have a question. I guess this is a question thing. So what is your day job, and are you going to give it up once your books take off?
Well, so far my day job consists of working at my Krav Maga school. As for whether I'll give it up when this goes, when the books get published, honestly, I don't know, Margo, for the simple reason that a lot of my time at the Krav Maga school, when I'm not working out, I'm at the computer writing. So I'm not sure if it's worth the time and energy just to quit, since I get so much time there by myself anyway. But right now it's a matter of, well, I want to keep my fight scenes somewhat accurate, so it helps when I go in, I get myself tossed around for about 2 to 3 hours, and then I go back to writing a fight scene where, you know what, this guy's going to get tired at this point.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. So, cool. Any other questions, Margo? Hello?
I'm still here. I sort of ran out.
Okay. Well, Margo, feel free to stay on the line if you have another question. You know, what I'll do is maybe when we take our break at the half-hour mark, I'll just check in with you and see if you have another question. If you want to hang on, you're more than welcome to.
Yeah, it's the only way I can listen. I don't know why Blog Talk Radio is kind of screwing up on me. It won't let me log in, and I can't listen live. So actually hanging out on the phone is just fine for me because I can hear you guys talk.
Great. Oh, listen, you don't even talk to me about Blog Talk Radio. Usually, you know, once per broadcast, I get kicked out as the host or something happens. Always some kind of breakdown. So I completely understand. So
I'll be here for moral support against, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'll check in with you at the half-hour mark, see if you have another question, and thank you for listening.
Great. Thank you.
So definitely, you know, though, you kind of get the best of both worlds because you're working and the place where you work allows you to spend a lot of time on the computer, so it's kind of like you're getting paid for both Krav Maga and writing to me.
Yes, but don't tell my employer that.
He doesn't listen to my show, does he?
Not that I know of, but
okay.
Anyway,
we'll
but just to throw in a bone to him, hi, I work at Protection Fitness Krav Maga in Hicksville, Long Island. Thank you. End of ad.
But, you know, it is really cool how, you know, real life, how you can incorporate real life into fiction. Like you were saying, I worked out and I realized, okay, I'm going to have my character get tired at this point. You know, as soon as you said that, I just realized how much fun you can have sort of incorporating real stuff into a fictional story.
Oh, yes. It's, well, sorry, you say incorporating reality into fiction, and all I can think is, wait, I did that trilogy, didn't I?
Well, you know, and one of the things, with A Pious Man, you know, I loved how, and it's kind of like what I did with this last project, too, is sort of take real events from history and put it into some kind of entertaining story. But I liked that you were able to correct the record, so to speak, you know, with the play The Deputy, which I had never even heard of. And I said that in my review. I'm sorry to say I had never heard of The Deputy until your book, but my gosh, it really gave me a total idea where that came from. But yet you're able to entertain people too. So how did that process work for you? I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Well, like I said earlier, step one was the research. And after that, it was simply a matter of, okay, well, how do you actually write this bloody thing? And, okay, step one, writing 101. When in doubt, kill somebody. You know, it's the first line that's supposed to grab people's attention, that sort of thing. And, gee, I tend to specialize in thrillers. So, when in doubt, dead body. It works for Robert Ludlum all the time. Or at least it used to. But, so, started out as a murder mystery. And all these little elements kept going into the individual characters. And what went from a simple murder mystery turned into a conspiracy, which turned out 4 or 5 different shootouts. And then it kind of spiraled. I've dedicated about 12 pages of this on my blog to just how much it spiraled. It went from, okay, so what character will work? What characters will work? And I started out with a simple trio because I wanted somebody who'd be involved in the entire history of the Vatican, so I put in the head of the Swiss Guards. I wanted somebody completely neutral, so I put in a Secret Service agent from America. And for somebody to be completely out of the argument altogether, I brought in an Egyptian cop, because Egypt was fairly neutral in almost all of it. Now, granted, when I wrote this, this was 2004, so...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So then, oh, look, Arab Spring. I have to put in a few lines. So that was always fun when real life comes in and just tramples everything. But yeah, after that, I had one character just sort of jump in who I hadn't planned to show up. I had already written him for another book. And it's like... Damn it, Sean. Pause. Okay, fine. So, and it just continued to spiral until it became, wow, why is my book 800 pages? And then it turned into a trilogy.
Okay, and that was my next question to you. Like, you know, did you know when you first sat down to write it that it was going to be a trilogy, but you just answered it without even me having to ask?
Well, so. If you want more details... believe it or not, the book that's called A Pious Legacy was, of all things, about 50 pages from the original 800-page monster. And it was 50 pages, and it's like, you know what, maybe I could spell out a few things here and there. And even those 50 pages spiraled into 240.
Amazing how that happens.
Yes, well, I believe it was Dorothy Sayers who, in her book, The Mind of the Maker, described, yes, it's amazing how much real life, how much characters in our books get away from us. Can you imagine what God feels like?
Hey, that's a really good point. So, you know, but one of the things about fiction, and I can't remember, it was somebody that I interviewed from the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook, which, by the way, shout out, guys, shout out to... Masha and Kia for starting the group, and for me, a personal shout-out to Jamie Wilson for adding me to the group, which is how I became a part of it. But, guys, you can check that out on Facebook if you're interested for readers and writers, Conservative Libertarian Facebook Alliance on – I'm sorry, Fiction Alliance. See, I always do that. Conservative Fiction Alliance on Facebook. Thank you very much. Okay, I got my plug in.
And that's why I don't bother with the initials.
What's that?
That's why I don't bother trying to spell it out by the initials.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a great group of people, and now I can't even remember, Declan, what my original question was. Oh, I had somebody from the CLFA when I interviewed him. I think it was Christopher Bunn, I'm pretty sure. And he made the point that fiction has to be more real than anything, like, you know, to be believable. I mean, it's like a paradox, but it's true.
I believe it was Tom Clancy who said, there's a difference between... fiction and reality. Fiction has to make sense.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. And that is so true.
Yes. Well, yes. Just imagine how many things we've heard in the news for the past year that have been so completely stupid, you can't make it up.
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, heck, The Week. I'm going to have some spoilers for Pious Legacy, but in Pious Legacy, I have a bit of business where it's the United Nations versus the Catholic Church. I won't go into details, but granted, in my version, there were more bullets. The Week, I had that go to print. The United Nations decided to come after the Catholic Church. I believe it was, you know, let's try to go after them for pederasty scandals. And, wait, hold on, pause. I just wrote this book! You're not allowed to do this!
That is quiet. Wow.
Yeah.
And, well, it sounds like you had a similar experience with Codename Winterborn.
Yeah, that was kind of creepy. The background, for anyone who hasn't been here for previous rounds, Codename Winterborn started actually as a prequel novel to something I was working on with my co-author, Alan Yaskowitz. He had developed a 90 pages on a dystopian world. I kind of jumped in, and it spiraled again. And originally, I had given a character a one-line backstory about how his team had been slaughtered in the People's Republic of France. I figured, okay, maybe I should do a few chapters on that. One book later, Codename Winterborn. Hell, Codename Winterborn spiraled so much, it ate the original book one. Quite literally, about 50 pages wound up in Codename Winterborn. And with that, it was, wait, I thought it might take 100 years for any political party to become just so callous with human life that they'd pull this kind of crap. And then Benghazi. Just, God.
Yeah, chilling.
Like I said, reality's got to make sense. Sorry, fiction has got to make sense. Reality, what kind of boneheads? But never mind, I'll start ranting at this point.
Well, we're going to rant about that soon enough. I want to first, so Declan, in terms of the publishing now, did you independently publish these books?
Oh, yes, both. Both The Pious Stuff and Codename Winterborn. As you read in the bio, I've got another book out there, but it's not that interesting. Just look at the reviews. Self-publishing is always fun, and by fun, I mean I'd rather have a root canal. But especially since not only am I writing the darn thing, I'm doing all the marketing, doing the covers or myself or paying somebody else to do the covers. And if you've ever seen the rates on most graphic artists, you know that's kind of larcenous after a while. And I'm quite grateful to have a publisher.
Yeah.
I'm so looking forward to it.
And it's funny, though, because technology has sort of turned the publishing industry upside down, too. So I think in your case, though, you'll have sort of, I think, the best of both worlds. A lot of the marketing is still going to be your responsibility, from what I understand. But yet, like you said, the graphic artists, the editing and the formatting and all that good stuff is going to be taken care of by the publisher. So,
not to mention the opportunity to actually get it on bookshelves.
Yeah, well, exactly, exactly. And as you know, I'm going to be doing a panel on May 20th. Something really different, a panel discussion, which I think you're going to be part of. I can't even remember. I'm sorry. I'm trying to keep track of all these shows. But we're going to talk about the pros and cons of independent publishing and what to look out for. And it's really going to be sort of like a publishing and marketing 101 type of a panel. We're going to assume that you've already written your book or you know how to write. I mean, I don't want it to be about the writing process, because I find that most people really need help with the self-publishing, marketing, how do I sell books process more than anything. I mean, one thing I've learned in the last five, six years, especially with doing social media, is that there's a lot of talent out there. That's not the issue. And yes, everybody needs an editor and all that good stuff. But that's really not the problem I'm finding. I mean, I think the problem is people really need help understanding, first of all, avoiding getting ripped off, because now, you know, the dark side of it is there's a lot of companies that will do that, will take advantage of new authors especially, and charge them exorbitant rates to self-publish their book. And if you don't know any better, you could fall into that trap. And so, you know, and then the flip side of that is there are a lot of good self-publishing companies out there, but it's a matter of knowing what to look for and how to go about it. So I'm looking forward to that panel on May 20th. But how did you decide, and who did you self-publish with, and how did you come to the decision to use that particular company?
Well, I used createspace.com, which was an offshoot of Amazon. I figured most people buy books from Amazon anyway, so might as well. Granted, there are some downsides to that, being you will never, ever get onto any bookstore shelves unless you buy your own ISBN, which I only learned after I tried talking to Barnes & Noble about, hi, this is my book, I'd like it on your shelves, I'd like to come by for signing and such, and it's like, and the general response was, you publish with an Amazon affiliate, go kill yourself.
So, nice.
Yeah, so live and learn. Then again, I made some other minor errors along the way. For example, I started out by pricing my Kindle copy at $9.99, which I didn't even own a Kindle at that point. In fact, now that I've got one that a friend of mine gave me because, well, I'm not using it anymore. Here, try it out. Got the Kindle copy. I may have read 3 books on it, but now I at least know that your basic Kindle book is priced at around $3.99 instead of $9.99.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Live and learn.
Well, and that was something I had to learn back in 2008, because I'm definitely a hold-the-book-in-your-hands kind of reader, you know, flip-the-pages kind of reader. I mean, I appreciate Kindle, and I understand why they're so popular, but I work on a computer all day long. When I want to read a book, I want to read an actual book, but you still have to cater to the vast market of people who will not read your book unless it's available on a Kindle. So you kind of have to satisfy that market if you're going to get your work out there. So that's a lesson I learned way back then.
Oh, yes. And that was another reason to go with CreateSpace, because it had an automatic connection to Kindle Direct Publishing. And very few people I know actually use a Nook. In fact, from what I heard last year at the Catholic Media Network Convention in New Jersey was that it sounds like Barnes & Noble is going to stop supporting the Nook sometime in the near future, but assuming it hasn't already. Barnes & Noble could have discontinued the Nook altogether, and I wouldn't have heard.
Very interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Well, for all I know, it could have been a rumor. But like I said, I'm not very connected into Nooks or e-books. Or my usual line is, could you buy mine? Thanks.
Now, let me ask you, though, do you tend to sell more Kindle than paperback, or how have you kept track of that?
Well, with some books, I have sold more Kindle. I think Codename Winterborn has been more Kindle-based than anything else. I'm not counting the free copies because, oh, look, free. People download it. They'll never read it. They'll never review it. It's kind of like going through a standard convention, a professional convention, and, oh, look, freebie. They never read any of the pamphlets or materials. They just go home with, like, a telephone book full of them. But
free, so they take it, yeah.
Yeah. And so with Pious Trilogy, I've actually sold more hard copies than I have Kindle. I don't know how that works. I don't know why that works. All I know is they bought them. So, it could be because there are just more traditional Catholics who prefer hard copy to electronic print, but I have no idea.
Yeah, see, and that's where, and you know, we're going to take a quick break, Declan, but when we come back, I want to talk about the marketing process a little bit more, because I think that's the hardest thing is the tracking.
Oh, yes.
It's very, very difficult to make a correlation between a particular effort you're making and book sales. It's just, I don't know, it's a very hard thing to quantify. And I want to get your thoughts on that. I want to talk about your blog and another thing, book trailers, too. I want to get your thoughts on that as well. So hang on, stand by. It's 1:30, so let's take a quick break. And we're going to talk about a little bit about the marketing process with Declan Finn when we come back.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Hi, this is Jennifer Coolidge. The American Heart Association says the disco song Stayin' Alive is the near-perfect beat for hands-only CPR. If you see a teen or adult collapse from cardiac arrest, you only need 2 steps to help save a life. Call 911 and push hard and fast in the center of the chest to the beat of the song Stayin' Alive. Disco is back and it's saving lives. To learn more, go to heart.org/hands-only-CPR.
Nationally supported by the WellPoint Foundation.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
And we are back. This is your host, Daria Ann. I am here with author Declan Finn. Declan, welcome back.
Thank you.
And so we just talked about sort of the writing process and some of your books, the Pious Trilogy, Codename Winterborn, Honor at Stake, which has just been picked up by Damnation Books, which is awesome. So Declan, I want to get into, you know, before we took a break, we were talking about the difficulty in quantifying marketing efforts. And I want to take a step back and ask you what you do to market your books, because I think another thing, and we're going to talk about this on our panel, I think a lot of new authors and just authors in general are overwhelmed because there are so darn many choices out there in terms of social media platforms. I mean, we've got Facebook, Goodreads, Twitter, Pinterest, all these things going on. And maybe they don't have the time to do them all, and they're trying to figure out which ones are the most important. And then again, we have some, you know, blogs, something called blogging. There's book trailers. So let's break this out a little bit. So let's start with social media platforms. Let's start with a blog. I mean, I know you have one. You have an excellent blog. How important do you think that is to your success, and do you recommend that all authors have one?
Well, I'm not sure if I recommend a blog anymore because, believe it or not, I'm actually going to kind of jump ahead a bit because it's a matter of how many people know you even exist. Let's face it, there are how many millions of self-published books out there? At least I think it's a few million by now. But you're still basically screaming and fighting for attention when in a crowd that could fill St. Peter's Square. And that's kind of hard unless you have a flare gun or a machine gun. But what I found recently is when I started writing for the American Journal, the first week, hold on, why are these people suddenly buying my books? And it wasn't somebody just found Declan Sin and bought one of each. It was the ones I was talking about in, you know, the small bios in the American Journal. And since American Journal has got about a million viewers a month, it's that kind of traffic. The amount of people who will buy anything you're trying, the amount of people who buy stuff you're selling is kind of like spam. Email spam or just plain junk mail in the real world, where junk mail was originally 1 in every 100 would actually come up with somebody who actually bought the product or showed continued interest in it. With the internet, same thing still applies. I have about 3,000 people a month looking at my blog, and trust me, that requires an awful lot of work. Daria, you introduced me to Hootsuite.
Yes, I did.
And the amount of time and energy spent programming next week, the next month, of social media activity, usually with links from my blog, and, you know, and of course, including the usual hashtags. On Friday, it's going to be Friday Reads or Music Monday or something like that. I think it's Throwback Thursday, and God knows what the other few days are. But despite all of that, oh, look, go to American Journal, right there for a week, suddenly all the sales shoot up. It's the same percentage of people who will actually follow up, 1% or less, but the higher traffic, congratulations, you now at least have more people to net that 1%. God knows, when I was trying early on in marketing, one of my earlier ideas was, okay, call in to Rush Limbaugh, use Alias, he gets 14 million listeners, I'll take 1% of that. So,
yeah.
That hasn't worked so well, mainly because I didn't know, like, 5 million people were trying to call in at any one time.
Well, and, you know, Declan, you bring up a really good point, because I've sort of evolved, like, with my blog now, just for my own stuff, because I do other things, you know, blogging for other people and social media and all kinds of stuff, and I kind of see my blog more as, like, a sort of like a dynamic resume, if you will, where I'll kind of, that's where I'll put that sort of thing, more professional things, and certainly I'll write some commentary there on culture and politics. But you're absolutely right, because I just started writing for the American Journal, too, and it's kind of like, why reinvent the wheel when you, if you have something that's already set up and it's already, like, the viewers are already there and you're invited to be a part of it, then why not? I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer to do that. So for me, yeah, and I totally agree with you. It's like trying, everybody has a blog now, and trying to, you know, to get yours noticed is just as you said. So I totally agree with that. I do think it's important to have one, though, just from a professional standpoint.
I
really love yours, because you do, and you do a lot of videos on yours.
Oh, yeah. Well, the amount of people I have seen on, well, how do I put this? You want to make a new celebrity? Go to YouTube. Lindsay Sterling is one of the more popular ones who's cropped up. She plays a violin and dances in interesting ways while still playing the violin. Congratulations. She's now an internet celebrity doing videos with, what's that guy's name? John Mayer, I think. I don't know. Some John Legend? Yes, some musician I don't know offhand. His latest hit is Basic Guy with a Piano Song. So, as you can tell, I'm really into popular culture and music. But,
yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, but, no, it's go to YouTube. People are attracted to bright, shiny objects. And, well, granted, that makes them sound something like ferrets or moths. It's still true. You put in some good music, you put in shiny visuals, people will actually show up. Granted, not too many people, unless you're paying for space on YouTube, which I don't know about you, but the YouTube commercials are starting to piss me off. Every time I just, oh, look, I'm going to watch a minute-long trailer for an upcoming TV show. Click on it, and I get another commercial that's 3 minutes long before I can get to the 45-second commercial.
It makes sense.
It's insane.
Yeah, no, it really is. But I do like on your blog how you do your little videos and your posting. And I do think it's important to have something in your own name that's out there. But
absolutely.
But Declan, now what about like with all these social media platforms we have now? Which ones do you use the most and why?
Well, I blog once to three times a week, depending. Which reminds me, I actually need to update mine. But I still use the blog. Facebook and Twitter are the consistent ones. YouTube, I used to have a vlog series. It lasted for a few months before I decided, wow, I don't even think people who watch my who go to my blog actually bother with those videos. So those kind of fell by the wayside, not to mention, oh, look, I'm busy doing five other things and editing a video. I think it's for every 10 minutes of video, I film for 1 hour because that's, sorry, 1 hour of work goes into every 10 minutes because it's just that much editing that goes into it.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a problem. And it's
a lot of work if you're not getting a payout from it or you know if you're not seeing results.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Some massive time suck.
Yeah, and that's one thing writers have to do is you have to figure that stuff out. If something is just a time drain, and it's not you're not getting any results from it, then time to set it aside and focus on the efforts that do. I have to say something, and this is probably gonna be sacrilegious, I guess, to a lot of writers, but I really cannot get into Goodreads. I'm on there. And I try to interact there, especially since so many of the good CLFA people are on there. But I'm wondering if you feel the same way or if you – I don't know. I just can't get into that. I don't know if it's the way it's set up. But it's not one I tend to use a lot of.
I think a lot of it has to do with the setup. I am so easily lost. I recently tried to set up my author page. And, okay, once you are verified as an author, you can't really do anything to your books aside from add them. To explain, A Pious Legacy had been listed on Goodreads as a second edition of A Pious Man instead of being the sequel. And, okay, I go in, I hit the button that says separate, and, sorry, you can't do this function. Go to a librarian. Wait, what?
Declan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Are you? Hello? Hello?
I cannot hear Declan. You know what? I opened the chat.
Hello? Hello?
Hello, everyone. This is Daria Ann, and yes, this is Write Stream Tuesday with author Declan Finn. I got kicked out as the host, and I see Declan is back on the line. So, you know, Declan, I was just saying to our caller that these things happen, and sure enough, BTR obliged me. So.
Yes, well, okay, to the NSA hacks who are trying to screw up the show, go screw yourselves. Thank you, Declan Finn.
Exactly.
God. Anyway. Not that I think the NSA is actually trying to take us out, although I wouldn't be surprised, maybe if they were bored.
Yeah. Perhaps. But I apologize because I don't remember where we were when BTR so rudely interrupted us. So I think we were talking about Goodreads.
Yes, we were. And I don't know what the last thing you heard me say was, but the sequel to my novel, A Pious Man, had been listed as the second edition. And I went in, I set myself up as author, went over, hit, click, separate this edition from the other edition, because it's a sequel. And then I was told, sorry, you have to get a librarian to do this. What? It's my book! So, it's an awkward setup. I go in very infrequently, mostly to check out Masha's page, which is one of the few places I have gotten people to read the book, because, oh, look, these are people who think similar to me. Not exactly, because if anyone thought exactly like me, I'd have to recommend them for some Florazine or maybe Haldol.
Yeah. Yes, and I want to just say, and Masha is wonderful, and I really appreciate, I mean, she has always given me the opportunity to promote things in her Goodreads group, and my dislike of Goodreads has nothing to do, you know, it's just, I guess it's just my own preference, and Declan, I'm glad to hear you say the same thing, because I've always found that site very, very confusing and sort of cumbersome to use, but that's not to say that it doesn't appeal to an awful lot of authors and readers, because it certainly does, so I think it's just finding the platforms that kind of resonate with each individual author.
Probably. And maybe I'm just too simple-minded, but I like something that's as streamlined as the original Facebook, because every time Facebook does something more to make it more flashy, all I could think is, don't turn into MySpace, don't turn into MySpace.
Yeah, oh gosh. Please no. Please no. So you use Twitter and Facebook mostly?
Twitter, Facebook, and blog.
And the blog, yes. Okay. And thanks to me, you use Hootsuite, which I do. I love Hootsuite. I upgraded because I manage social media for other people too, and it allows you to have sort of unlimited accounts. It's still very cheap, but I mean, their free version is wonderful for anybody who just, and it's such a time saver because you can just go to one place and update all the platforms you happen to be using. And it just makes it so much easier. And especially with Twitter, I found that so many people that I work with and train on Twitter, because Twitter is very confusing, I think, in the beginning for a beginner. And Hootsuite makes it so much more logical with the columns, and you can kind of see what's coming in and when you're mentioned and how to reply to people and retweet things. So I think a lot of those tools are also really helpful.
Definitely.
And now let's talk about book trailers, Declan. Pro, con, are they worth the investment? What are your thoughts on that?
Are they worth the investment? Probably not, I'm sad to say. Consider how many, quote, professional authors, the ones who are actually published by big-name publishing companies. Notice how many of them do book trailers. Answer, I think, boils down to one, James Patterson, mainly because he's the Book of the Month Club now. He'll pump out, what, 12 books a year with six co-authors. And with him, they need to have the book commercials come out on television because that's the only way to keep track of what he's writing. But I have been doing them because I find them fun. And if it gets me even one reader, I'll take it. But are they worth it? Sadly, I don't think so.
So what is the typical, I mean, what does it cost typically? Is there a range of costs for a good book trailer?
Well, in my case, all of mine have been production value of nothing because I designed them myself from scratch. The music I will usually take from someone I have heard before because on YouTube, they will only really penalize you if you're trying to make money off of your trailer. Oh, sorry. If you're trying to make money off the YouTube video, it better have all original content. In my case, the music is not original content, but I'm not trying to make money off the trailer. I'm trying to make money off the book. So I can just easily pick what I like. That's hopefully not going to get me thrown off at YouTube. I haven't been yet so far. And just set the images to the music, and I'm off to the races. I've got a digital camera that's not 100%, but very few people are going to start freezing the video every 2 seconds because most of the video clips I use are 5 seconds or less. Most of what I use are still photos, but if you put them together fast enough, it looks like motion.
Now, you do that with, like, movies, Windows Movie Maker?
Yep.
Well, and then that's another good thing, I mean, because you can teach yourself to use these tools. And so if you are on a tight budget, you can still create a decent trailer, because yours are excellent, I think. So
thank you.
Whether, you know, and whether trailers equal book sales or not, and apparently, I guess, from your experience, they don't, I think they're still kind of a cool thing to have as part of your advertising.
Oh, yes.
It's kind of like the blogging.
True. And a lot of times it will probably retain the interest of what readers you do have. Kind of like newsletters are not so much for getting new readers, but they are for keeping the ones you've already got.
Yes. So do you recommend that, Declan? Because I have a friend, my good friend, author Renee Gatz, she does a monthly newsletter. That's wonderful. And she always tailors it around what's going on that particular month. So, for instance, this month has sort of like a Mother's Day theme, and she's able to apply that to – and it's not about buy my book, which is another mistake I think a lot of newbies make. I mean, her newsletters are about engaging readers on topics that interest them, themed by whatever happens to be going on that month. And it's a way of just kind of, like you're saying, keeping her existing readers engaged and up to speed on what's going on with her. You know, she does a lot of local speaking engagements and things like that. So do you do a monthly newsletter or any sort of regular newsletter to your readers?
Well, I don't do enough in the course of the average month to fill a newsletter. Most of what I have done involves, okay, hi, I'm going to be online with Daria Ahn this week. And that's pretty much enough to... That's pretty much all I do in terms of activities. For everything else, that would probably imply a social life. But no, for the most part, newsletters are kind of like, well, for me, they're kind of like videos. They eat up a lot of time. I would love to do them, but between writing my regular books, I'm currently, hold on, how many books am I doing right now? I'm waiting for Edits on a Pious Stand, which is book 3. I'm waiting on my co-author. Well, I'm not really waiting on my co-author. I'm just writing the sequel to Codename Unsub for the most part. And I'm waiting for the editor to get back to me on Honor at Stake while I'm writing the sequel to Honor at Stake.
Wow.
So I'm too busy for a newsletter. Unless what I'm going to do is fill his newsletter with excerpts of what I've written, which would probably be the only way I could fill a newsletter. And after a while, why would anyone want to be bothered buying the book? They could just read the newsletter.
Well, yeah, and that's why, you know, and again, it depends on the needs of each individual author and where you're at. So
exactly.
You know, so not every tool is going to work for every author, but it's great that we have so many options out there now, because it really does take its consistent effort to engage your existing readers, find new ones, you know, talk to them, find out what they're interested in, and hopefully sell books. You know, it's just it's an ongoing, constant process.
Oh, definitely. But I'll give you a for instance. I'm actually on the newsletter for three different authors, since Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child write as a team. But other than that, the only other fellow I follow is James Rollins. And I've got 3 newsletters in my email that I have been sitting there for the last 2 to 3 months, and I still haven't gotten to them. So, again, it's a matter of what works, what doesn't. I honestly don't know.
And a matter of prioritizing, because you seem to have your priorities straight. I mean, the focus obviously needs to be on writing your books. I mean, that's first and foremost. If you don't have a book, it doesn't matter if you have an audience. You know, you don't have an audience, and if you have nothing to sell, I mean, there's really no point to any of it. So it's kind of that balancing act. But it sounds like you figured it out, at least for yourself, what works best for you and how to manage your time appropriately.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
But there, I'm, it's going to be very interesting to see exactly how this turns out once I actually get, once Honor at Stake is published with a real live publishing house. And I have no idea how that's going to change the dynamics of what I'm currently doing.
That'll be really interesting to see. Now, when is that coming out?
No idea. Keep in mind, I only signed the contract a little over a week ago. So it might be a few months. Just maybe.
So you don't even know. I mean, it would be really cool if it involved, you know, a little book tour maybe locally or, you know, it'll be interesting to see what kinds of events they'll have you involved in.
Well, what I'm actually looking forward to that because it'll be, I'm actually doing real work. I believe they're called The Problems of Success. Congratulations, you've just published a book. Now you've got to do another 40 hours a week just trying to sell it. I'll take it, as long as it works. But, So I've actually already started making comments to the marketing folks who, where it's, hi, I've got this science fiction convention and this science fiction convention I want to try going to. Could you guys help me get into these? Thanks. So hopefully the tour is going to involve a lot of science fiction conventions because that's going to be my audience. And those people I at least know how to work with because I've been on the other side. I'm a nerd, so I go to sci-fi conventions a lot. I'm not one of those folks who dresses up because most of those costumes, oh, my God, I'd probably blind people. The amount of people who show up at, for example, Dragon Con in Atlanta, and they show up in Spartan armor and capes and helmets and no shirts. Some of them, I'm sure, look fine, and some of them are obviously, good God, please put clothes back on. You're not supposed to look like that if you're dressing up as from 300. You know, and one of the popular outfits is, I'm not sure if you're a Star Wars fan, but the Princess Leia gold bikini from Return of the Jedi. And you see, well, let's just say on some people it is an inappropriate costume.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. So
I live very close to the beach and, you know, or a few miles from the beach, and trust me, when I do get there, which is not very often, I'm always amazed by what I see. It's kind of like, you know, that expression, like, not every thought in your head needs to come out of your mouth. Well, not every style or bikini needs to be worn by everyone. I'll just put it that way, to put it diplomatically. So.
Anyway, let's move on to something else before I have to bleach my brain.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know what, Declan, we're coming up on the hour, and so why don't we take a little bit of a longer break. I'll give you a chance to get some water, stretch, and then when we come back, let's talk about the American Journal, your article there, what's going on with Benghazi, and anything else that's on your mind.
All right. Look forward to it.
All right. Sounds good. All right, everybody, stand by, and we will be back here in a few minutes.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can. But we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a day. cherished freedom. Freedom never cries. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all, you can cry for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop, a flag to a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dead.
Welcome back to Write Stream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. I'm here with author Declan Finn, and you just heard Five for Fighting, Freedom Never Cries, a tribute to the U.S. military. Always appropriate, but especially appropriate this month when we will be commemorating Memorial Day in a few weeks. So, Declan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for sticking around with me. And you know, that listening to that song, I'll tell you, it makes me even more incensed when I think about the next topic we're going to cover, and that is Benghazi. And you've written about this for theamericanjournal.com. So I'm going to have you kind of fill us in, you know, on the latest story you posted there. But you know, when I think about the honor of our military and how much they wanted to help and do whatever they could the night of that attack, I just get incensed at this cover up and just absolutely disgusting. I mean, when you were saying earlier about fiction and reality, yeah, that applies here. So tell us a little bit about your latest post about Benghazi and what's going on.
Okay, well, just to fill in those folks who are not news junkies and have to be connected to the Internet 24 hours a day just to keep up, Judicial Watch just recently won a Freedom of Information Act suit against, I believe it was just the Obama White House in general, about, gee, we want to see documents related to lead up on basically blaming the Benghazi attack on a YouTube video. What we got was, I think, about 100, maybe a few hundred emails that detail, rather intricate detail, a process of covering up and blaming the entire Benghazi incident on a YouTube video. The talking points were there and up to and including saying, oh, well, we got the YouTube video tip from the CIA. Really, we did. Honest. Pinky swear. No, those are just plain old talking points issued by the White House. Say it's Obama, say it was Hillary. Either way, they were probably both involved. And it's actually gained so much attention that even Speaker John Boehner has decided to make some movements on it by assigning a representative who used to be a prosecutor to actually looking into the events, now that Daryl Issa has probably more emails than he knows what to do with about it. But, yes, in case your listeners were wondering about, gee, was there a cover-up with Benghazi? The answer is yes! Oh, good God, was it yes.
Oh, disgusting. I mean, and you know what, Declan, there's so much of this, so many aspects of this that just absolutely stink to high heaven. You know, starting with the fact that, starting with the fact that they were ordered to stand down and not even, you know, there are military not that far away that wanted to help their fellow Americans who were told to stand down. You know, the event itself and the negligence there, all for political expediency. But then the fact that you have an American jailed for his, you know, expressing his First Amendment rights for a video that had absolutely nothing to do with what happened. And to the best of your knowledge, is this guy still in jail or has he been released or what's going on with that?
To the best of my knowledge, he's been thrown into the darkest hole the government has. I don't think he's been thrown into Gitmo yet, but he could be for all I know, for all anyone knows, really. And the one reason I didn't bring up about the stand-down order is, do we even know who gave the stand-down order? We don't know where Obama was, because we know he wasn't in the Situation Room, because somebody who was there said, no, wasn't there. I have no idea where he was. Go ask him. This is the President of the United States of America. We have all but low-jacked him. We have all but put GPS chip under his skin just to keep track of where he is all the time. And nobody knows where he was during the, how long was the attack? 12 hours? And we have no idea where the fleet he was?
And they still haven't answered that simple question to this day. 20 months after it happened, where were you?
Yeah.
No one has held him to account for that. No one.
So that's why I haven't brought up the stand down order, because who gave it? Who ultimately gave it? Because it should be Obama as commander-in-chief for, you know, whatever good that has done. But if it came for all we know, it could have come from a political operative like Lois Lerner, at which point it's an illegal order, it violates the chain of command, and somebody should be going to jail just for that alone. But we don't know, and I'm not going to try testifying to facts not in evidence just yet. But, geez, if Obama gave the stand-down order, that's criminal.
Impeachable, I would think.
One would hope. But, to quote a friend of mine, Jason, even Jimmy Carter bothered trying to send a helicopter or two in Iran in the 70s. We couldn't be bothered sending one of Obama's favorite Predator drones. You know, he only killed a few thousand people using those. And
begs another question, Declan. What was going on? Why were they even there in the first place? You know, what was going on? And I think that's at the heart of this whole cover-up.
Well, which they? Stevens or the mob outside?
Well, I'm saying, why was Stevens sent there and what was really going on? Yeah, I mean, what was the motivation for sending him there? What were we doing? You know, those are the questions I would like to see answered.
Well,
sacrificial lamb. I know that we're getting into conspiracy theory here, but go ahead.
Well, come on. I think we passed conspiracy theories after the 100 documents got released. Good God. Does this man want to be president or does he want to be a Bond villain? Because so far I've seen more evidence that he wants to be a Bond villain. Just from those emails. So, conspiracy, check. We're already there. But as far as what Stevens was doing in Benghazi, there have already been the consistent theory that I have seen is the United States armed the quote-unquote rebels in Libya. If you remember, the rebels in Libya were actually largely al-Qaeda. We gave weapons to al-Qaeda members. The theory is that Stevens was out in Benghazi trying to get the weapons back and promptly got killed for his troubles. So, if that's the case, where do you even want to start? Do we throw people in jail for arming al-Qaeda? Because we've already armed narco-terrorists down in Mexico. Nobody's been arrested for that yet. See Eric Holder, Fast and Furious.
And so Brian Terry was a sacrificial lamb in that whole fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
No justice for him or his family at this point.
So,
yeah,
I'm trying to count the bodies that Obama has left on the floor by now. So from what I can tell, it's four Americans in Benghazi, the two or three DEA border or DEA agents killed by fast and furious guns. And those are just the American citizens. Oh, he's nuked one by Predator drone. Granted, he might have been a terrorist-sympathizing schmuck, but he was still American citizen and offed by the government. And so that's seven right there. And that's not counting how many civilians were taken out by collateral damage and drone strikes. I think that's in the 3,000 range by now. We've killed at least 300 Mexican citizens because of the fast and furious guns. I'm sorry. Right now, if the President of the United States were able to go before war crimes tribunals, I'd happily offer Obama over right at this point, because he has probably killed more people illegally. Yeah, no, actually, if you go by 9/11 numbers, congratulations. Obama has killed more civilians than 9/11.
Wow. Gosh, when you put it that way, it really, that's a real punch in the gut. Right there. Now, Declan, do you feel pretty good about Trey Gowdy heading up this special investigation? And what are the odds on how long this is going to take?
Well, how long it's going to take is going to depend on a few factors. One, from what I've seen of Trey Gowdy, I haven't done a heck of a lot, but I've heard some fairly good things. Described him on the American Journal as kind of like that scene from Jaws where you've got Roy Scheider chumming the water, the shark's head pops out for just a moment, and Scheider turns to the captain and says, "You're going to need a bigger boat." Well, instead of the shark popping out of the water, it's these Judicial Watch documents on covering up Benghazi, and the bigger boat is Trey Gowdy. Like I said, it's like somebody finally took it seriously, which I'm happy with. As for the speed, that's going to depend on several factors. One, we know how fast Congress works about the speed of molasses frozen. And, however, but if Judicial Watch has more documents than they've released, we don't know how many documents they've got, do we? Because if they've got more than they've put out already, and they're basically releasing them for maximum effect, a few at a time, and maybe Daryl Issa, maybe Gowdy has got these documents ahead of everyone else. Because, let's face it, if you or I were in Boehner's position, we probably would have sicked the dogs on Benghazi within a week or less. But Boehner has dragged and Boehner has dragged his feet for so long in doing anything. You know that either one, these documents have made a lot of puzzle pieces fall into place, and even Boehner has basically got a gun to his head saying, "You know what? Yeah, let's go after them now." Or two, there's more information than we don't know right now. But they do, and they're now going to unleash the hounds. So either way.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, and I applaud Judicial Watch. I mean, God bless them. Thank God they exist. But I just find it's a travesty that it even had to come to that. To them filing a lawsuit, I mean, this information should have been provided to Congress. And I mean, it should be very troubling to every American that this administration refuses to cooperate. I mean, I just don't understand what it's going to take before although 51% is it now, believe that we should have an investigation. So, I mean, that's heartening, but I thought, geez, my God, I mean, what's it going to take to get that number to like 80%, 85, 90?
It's probably going to take either an act of God or all the news organizations finally caving. Because keep in mind, Woodward and Bernstein made taking out a president the gold standard. in journalism. And even Woodward and Bernstein have actually said, yeah, that's one thing we'd actually want to take back about Watergate. Because it's now what every journalist wants to shoot for. If that kicks in with Obama, we're going to have a lot of fun. As in, I don't expect Obama to be getting a heck of a lot done. Now, again, got a few friends who are thinking, if he survives the year politically, it'll be a cute trick. I'm not that optimistic, but we'll see. I may have had a point to that other than that, but I forgot it. I got lost in my head, sorry.
Well, look, anyone who knows me knows I am not a fan of the permanent political class of either party. I mean, you know, and I think I can speak for you, Declan, when I say that we want the truth, which is something we have not been – it's been one deception after another with this administration. And since we're, what, six years into it, this is the administration we're talking about. Yeah, previous ones were corrupt. Fine. But let's deal with present reality. You know, because I hate that stonewalling you get from others, you know, and I just, honestly, I think we have fellow citizens who, regardless of the media, they're just so brainwashed and indoctrinated that they're never going to believe that this president or anyone in his administration or anybody with a D after their name could possibly do anything wrong. And, of course, yeah, the media is at fault for that. But, you know, Declan, even with the media, I mean, what is it going to take for them to recognize that eventually he's going to come after them, too? So maybe you want to start standing up for the truth.
Well, there are some who seem to have already gotten that. After all, he's wiretapped what? He's wiretapped the AP.
James Rosen?
Yeah. Fox. He's already gone after reporters. And he's prosecuting a reporter for treason, for releasing a story, which is completely unheard of. They've gone after the people who've leaked the information before, but going after the reporter for doing his job, unheard of. Absolutely and completely.
Yeah.
And when I know there's something off when there are even members of MSNBC who are reporting Obama in a less than positive light. Hell, last September, I think it was, even Chris I Get Tingles Up My Leg Matthews said, where was he on Benghazi? What the heck's going on? Why aren't you answering my questions? It was kind of strange, since it is Chris Matthews. But when even his most rabid fans are starting to ask questions, you know something's up.
Yeah.
But
so you're saying
the
tingles have subsided, Declan?
I suspect so, and I'm sorry, I even brought up the image. Now I've got to bleach my brain. Oh, Chris Matthews, tingly. Anyway.
Well, you know, especially for the families of these four brave Americans and anyone and all the others who were murdered, I mean, I sincerely hope that it's not a long time before we finally get justice. Not that it's going to make anyone feel better, but it will at least allow, I think, these grieving families to sort of have some sort of peace, knowing that those who are responsible were brought to justice. Which actually, Declan, leads me to another story, and I know we didn't plan on talking about this one, but it just popped into my head now as sort of a related issue, on a smaller scale, of course, but I'm sure you heard about the criminal on death row who we're supposed to feel sorry for because he suffered for 45 minutes before he finally died, by lethal injection?
Yeah.
And after I read what this monster did to his victim, just couldn't for him. This was, I believe, in Oklahoma. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, that's right. You haven't read Codename Winterborn yet, have you?
Not yet. Sorry, I know.
No.
My reading list. I'm sorry.
No, it is not a criticism. It's just, well, let's just say if you had, you'd pretty much know my thoughts. Now, I'm one of those people where I don't think you want me in an interrogation room being the interrogator because I'm relatively certain I will have no moral qualms about, well, torturing a bastard to death, period. That just might be a strange quirk in my head, or maybe I'm a sociopath and never got around to figuring it out. But I'm sorry, if you're going to torture, maim, or rape your victims before they're dead, before you kill them, even the general prison population hates those guys. They're the reason why a lot of serial killers never make it to dying of natural causes. Even your average killer in jail knows there's something off about them. This guy, I'm surprised he even made it to the death penalty. That's one of my problems with lethal injection. Oh, it's kind of like putting a dog to sleep. One, that depends on the chemicals, because a lot of the time they will, quote, anesthetize the scumbag in question before injecting the cyanide. And a lot of people have varying responses to pain-killing drugs. For example, I was on Vicodin for having four wisdom teeth pulled at the same time. Pop three Vicodin, still hurts. I'm a little sleepy, but it still hurts. So that's pretty much what this guy went through, if I understand it correctly. But one, I don't care about his pain. Hopefully it's going to be a very, very small sample of what he's going to be enjoying for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, exactly.
Two, okay. I prefer the electric chair if only because it's more reliable. And you get to go with the phrase, you try them and fry them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's keep in mind, his victim was 19 years old. I mean, a young woman had her whole life ahead of her. I mean, she was brutally raped and beaten and had to watch while he dug her grave. So you know what? Yeah, sorry, bleeding heart liberals, but I just can't muster any tears for this guy. And in fact, maybe it was divine intervention. God just thought he would enhance his well-deserved suffering a little bit. That's how I see it.
Oh, I'm perfectly content to leave it up to the stupidity of human agency, because, let's face it, if it were God, oh, look, here's hell.
Yeah.
We don't need to make this man suffer on the physical plane. That's what we've got the afterlife for.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so that's why I brought that up, because at least, you know, in this case, and I believe she was an only child, it's really sad. And obviously nothing is going to bring her back to her parents, but at least they can have some sort of peace knowing that the monster who took her away from them after brutally raping and beating her got his just desserts, finally. You know, my only quibble with this, though, Declan, is, you know, why does it take so freaking long? You know, they get the death penalty, they're convicted, they're proven guilty, and then they sit there for 20 years. 25 years,
oh,
yes. Wasting taxpayer money.
Oh, yes. Well, it's the appeals process. And I think it's almost automatic in these cases, so there's really nothing to be done about just short-circuiting it. Unless you're in Texas, where I think they'll kill you in 10 years or less.
God bless Texas.
Well...
Anyway, well, listen, Declan, let's take our final break, and when we come back, I have another sort of controversial topic, something that's been bugging me for a long time on Facebook, and you kind of, without realizing it, when you said earlier about, you know, people who are like-minded but don't, you know, that I don't agree with 100%, and that's for me, too. I mean, I think life would be boring if we all agreed 100%, but this is one of those areas where I see too much intramural fighting, if you will, that's not helpful to our common cause of liberty. So hang on for me. We're going to take another quick break. I am going to play Ava Aston's tribute to the U.S. military, a beautiful ballad called I Carry You With Me. And then we're going to come back to Right Stream Tuesday with Declan Finn.
All right.
To sit and ponder why.
All right, and that was the lovely, talented patriot Ava Aston, her ballad, I Carry You With Me, a tribute to the U.S. military. You can find out more about Ava at her website, avaaston.com. And, of course, this is Daria DiGiovanni, host of Right Stream Tuesday. I'm here with author Declan Finn, who's been hanging with me now for almost 2 hours. How you doing, Declan?
Oh, I'm holding up fine. Yourself?
I'm doing fine. This is a lot of fun, and I always love talking to you. And Declan's been a frequent guest on the program. And so we're talking about current events. And Declan, before we went to break, I mentioned that something that's been on my mind, and I'm kind of quiet about it. I don't think I've really talked about it much in CLFA, although I blogged about it, and I certainly did a post for the American Journal about it the other day. And it's this sort of intramural fighting, I call it, that goes on. Well, how do I want to say this? Between the various denominations of Christianity. And look, here's my position. As long as your religion does not involve human sacrifice, genital mutilation, wife beating, suicide bombing, flying airplanes into buildings and killing innocent people, you know, convert or die, I honestly don't care what you do. I recognize that if you are a believer in the Constitution and limited government and religious freedom, I can respect anybody's religion. I don't have to believe it. But if we're united in the cause of religious liberty for all, I don't think it's very helpful to be attacking other people because they're Catholic or Mormon or whatever, you know, Presbyterian. And I see a lot of that going on Facebook, and I personally see that it's very destructive. What do you think? Have you noticed any of this?
Well, most of my problems, what I personally encountered, have been with atheists. I even had a friend who was kind of supportive of a pious man before he learned that it was actually pro-Catholic. And he, oh my God, the amount of bile that can be generated is interesting. But as far as interdenominational, I've never really run into that, though I know it's out there. God, do I know it's out there. Wound up running into one reviewer. She loved a pious man, but said, wow, when I was growing up, I wasn't even allowed to date a Catholic boy. I didn't know all this stuff about Catholics. I didn't know they were Christians. At which point, I just wanted to slam my head against the desk a few times, and hopefully it would all go away. But, no, part of the problem with interdenominational feuds is they go back 500 years, and even if you exclude the Catholic Church from it, this is where being a history nerd does come in handy. I don't know if you were aware, but not long after Martin Luther died, the Catholic Church tried to reconcile with the various and sundry Protestant denominations. And by Protestant, for the record, I am referring to anyone who is Christian, but not Catholic or Greek Orthodox. And the reason those talks with the Catholic Church fell apart was that the Protestants had been quibbling with each other so much, the entire process went to pieces.
Yeah.
So,
oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. But like I said, it is 500 years in the making. Not to mention, that was when there were maybe a few dozen different sects.
Yes.
But
S-E-C-T-S. Now, for anyone listening.
Yes. Sorry, I do have a lisp. But,
I'm just teasing. Oh,
no.
Okay.
But no, it's now in America alone, how many subdivisions of Baptists do we have? You know, the Ninth Southern Baptist Church, 12th Reformation, Subdivision Congress of 1920 or something equally ridiculous, where even within one particular strain of Protestantism, if you will forgive me the virology term, even within one strain, you've got so many different separations and splinter groups off of such small details and small bits of doctrine. That's one of the reasons I love the Catholic Church. Hi, Yes, we have saints. You don't like saints? Congratulations. You don't need to believe in saints. You don't need to believe in any miracle outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the Eucharist.
Yes.
Catholics are relatively easygoing like that. But the some of the groups where, once upon a time, there was a good southern website. It was called Vatican.com, not VaticanVeet.va, because that one is run by the Vatican. Vatican.com used to have articles on why the Pope wore the great big hat to cover up the horns and the long cape to cover up the tail and the cloven hooves. And that's just with the great big Mother Church from Rome. When it gets to intersectarian squabbling, it feels like Hatfields and McCoys after a while. And for the most part, a lot of these quibblings are like civil wars, the most vicious wars you can possibly come up with, because both sides are going to be counted in the tally.
Well, look, here's my thing, and it's funny because I haven't been attacked by atheists. I haven't had that pleasure yet, but I do know, now believe it or not, I've met a lot of atheists who are staunch supporters of the Constitution, religious expression. They support religious liberty. Robert is one of them, our mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Steve, who I co-hosted a show with for 4 years, he's an atheist. Same thing, respects religious expression, has no problem with the Ten Commandments being on a courthouse. I mean, he's a constitutionalist. And I guess my thing is, look, you are free to believe that this other group is wrong and only the Bible you read is the right one, and if you read the NIV version, you're going to hell, and all these crazy things like going back and forth. That's fine, but what I'm saying is when you go on the attack against somebody because maybe they're reading a Bible that you don't like, or maybe they pray to a saint to intercede on their behalf to God, which is really what that's about. But like you said, that's totally optional. Whatever it is, I don't even care. They can believe the most ridiculous false things about any one particular brand of Christianity. I don't care. But what I'm saying is when you start alienating other people over that, when those other people would otherwise be united with you in the common cause of religious liberty and the Constitution, it's not helpful. It's very destructive. That's my biggest thing. I mean, you know, in 2012, my problem with Mitt Romney was not his Mormonism. I really don't care that he's a Mormon. Fine. Believe whatever you want. My problems were his policies, and I thought he was the weakest candidate to put up against Obama, and he was. But it had nothing to do with his religion. So I just find it – I think there's a way to stand up for what you believe without alienating and attacking other people who might not believe the same thing. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, this is true. By the way, to back up a step, with reference to Rob being, yes, he's an atheist, but he's also a libertarian. He doesn't care what you believe. As you know, you believe what you like, I'll believe what I like, and as long as we're not messing with each other, we're all happy, which a lot of the time that's pretty much my attitude. But with atheists, it's you got too many people of the Richard Dawkins school who has made it a doctrine to insult other people. I'm not even joking. He might as well be the high bishop of atheism, and that's one of his dogmas. But
a religion in itself, that's the irony of it. They've turned it into atheism into a religion.
Yep. And hey, when Dawkins is writing the holy books, of course he's going to have a few things to say about it. But no, with the intersectarian bickering of people who mostly agree with each other, I don't know. I think I usually just chalk that up to my general belief that people are stupid. Sadly, they are for a large part people in groups are usually stupid, stupider than individuals. I don't know why that is, but as soon as they get into a mob, the general IQ seems to be half the average of whatever the mob is, mob's individual members.
That is true, yes.
Yeah, actually, come to think of it, I think that actually goes back to an Ann Coulter book, which was on the liberal mob called Demonic. And Gotta ask though. You look at all those good black churches that host Democratic candidates, and you got to wonder how much of the problems are religious and how much still are political. Because yes, I believe under the C.S. Lewis term mere Christianity, all those good black Baptist Southern churches believe, for the most part, in what everyone else believes in. But they're going to back Al Gore, Bill Clinton, trying to remember how many of them actually backed Obama. But that's where politics start to get in the way. That's where little local disputes get in the way, I think, which is actually what gets in the way of most religion. Nationalists, in the larger view, it's nationalist or local politics get in the way of the religion.
Yeah, and listen, to be fair, Declan, you know, I remember when I was a little, my mother has always been a conservative activist. My grandfather was, he was a pharmacist. I mean, he graduated in 1919 from Temple University with a pharmacist degree and was always an entrepreneur, staunch anti-communist. So that's how my mother was raised on. She passed that on to all of us. And I guess as the youngest, I was the most affected by it. But listen, I got to tell you, I remember helping her out, handing out flyers at different polling locations, and the nuns would come in, and you know, they were all voting Democrat, because Democrats help poor people. And my mother would say, sure, sister, go pull the lever for Bob Edgar, who was, like, at the time a local guy that was a pro-abort Democrat. You know, go pull for Bob Edgar. And they would. And, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean any disrespect here, but I went off through Catholic school, and I couldn't understand the disconnection between how they, what I was being taught and what they were voting for. You know, it's crazy.
Well, hey, everyone knows that Catholics are slow to adopt. To adapt, and let's face it, a lot of these folks are still living in the 1940s, before there was abortion, before the pill even came into place, and there is too much within the Catholic Church. This is, you know, an interchurch problem, that there are too many people who are looking at social justice and seeing it as, oh, look, communism. That's social justice, right? Even though the Catholic Church has condemned communism since the mid-30s under Pius XI, we're in a very little-known move where the same week he condemned fascism, he condemned communism in back-to-back encyclicals. But unfortunately, you had, I believe somebody once described Vatican II as, yes, John Paul the 23rd had Vatican II to open up the windows of the Catholic Church and let the air in. Unfortunately, if you make it more as, gee, the church moving through history, and you make the church a train instead of a stationary object, the church was going through a tunnel filled with poison gas, and we've let a lot of that crap in. See, liberation theology in Latin America, which was mostly communist, infected the Jesuits for a great deal. I think that's a lot of our translation problems with Pope Francis. Not that I actually think he's a communist, but I think that's where some of the terminology gets confused.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Go ahead. Yep.
Yeah. And so, like I said, that's the Catholic problem. Back in the, late 50s, my parents told me this story of a rather insane nun who was Sister Dottie, as you know, Dottie by name, Dottie by nature, and saw a kid, with, you know, wearing a blazer, wearing Nixon campaign buttons. And she took the campaign buttons off of him. It's like, would you like these back? Yes, sister. Hold out your hands. He held them out, palms up, and she drove the campaign buttons into his palms because she voted for JFK.
Oh my God!
And there was a, I don't know if you were aware, but there was a movement for a few years where after JFK had been assassinated, there were some who tried to canonize the bugger. You know, that was decades before anyone heard of how many women he had on the side and how big of a schmuck he was. But, like I said, that's been a problem kicking around, at least the American Catholic Church, for years. And I do say the American Catholic is a very specific brand of stupid as opposed to the rest of church doctrine.
Well, you know, and that's true. I have to say that I would go home and get, like, deprogrammed by my parents, you know, my mom especially. No, and I went to Catholic school. That's what I say to people, you know, it's not just public school where there's the potential for indoctrination. I mean, you got to be careful. I mean, I remember, let me date myself here. I was in high school when Reagan was running for a second term, and I was, you know, I worked on the yearbook, and I was sitting in the yearbook office one day and overheard this conversation between a lay teacher and a priest, and they were wringing their hands over the fact that they didn't know who to vote for because Reagan was pro-life, but he was a warmonger, and yet Mondale was for peace, but he was pro-abortion. And I sat there thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I can't believe, and obviously I didn't say anything. I was, you know, 16, 17, whatever. I wasn't going to get in the middle of that one, but I remember thinking to myself, are these people for real? Only because this was the dinner conversation we were having every night at home, you know, as a family. We did talk about this stuff, among other things. So, you know, I think no matter where your kids are going to school, you really need to be on top of what they're learning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So.
Very interesting. Well, Declan, we've got a few minutes left here. I want to give you an opportunity. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to mention while we're still on the air?
Oh, not particularly. I think we covered an awful lot, you know, and God knows I don't want to add too many more comments that makes me sound like a complete sociopath in the making, especially with my thoughts on, yeah, sure, let's torture this. Wait, this is a PG-rated show, right?
Well, I try, but it's the Internet. We can, you know, we can kind of do what we want.
Yeah, well, I think I've made quite enough commentary on a lot of things. If you have any more questions, feel free to ask.
Well, let's do this. Let's let people know where they can find you if they want to buy your books, check out your blog, follow you on Twitter. Let's give out all that good information before we sign off.
Okay. Well, I've got A Pious Man, a Holy Thriller. Pious, in this case, is P-I-U-S, as in the Pope. Codename Winterborn. It's spelled like it sounds. You can find it all on Amazon. My blog is also apiousman.blogspot.com. On American Journal, just type in Declan Finn, and you can trip over all of my colorful commentary on current events, which is mostly either common sense or snark set to kill. And let me see. Twitter, A Pious Man Novel, or at A Pious Man Novel if you're going to be picky.
Twitter's picky, you know.
Yeah, this is true. Hold on. Let me see. I don't think I'm on LinkedIn because, frankly, I've never found any use for it. You can trip over me on Goodreads with Declan Finn. I'm kicking around every other week or so. Hold on, blog, Twitter, Facebook. Oh, yes, Facebook. I've got two pages. One is called simply The Pious Trilogy, and the other is Codename Winterborn. It's the only other page I've got since it's not connected to the current universe. Let me see. Am I missing anything? No, I think that's sufficiently more information than your listeners want to be bothered with.
Well, please, if you're on these platforms, follow Declan. And also, let me give another shout-out to the CLFA, the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, on Facebook. If you're a reader, a writer, an up-and-coming author, and you want to join our group, if you are of a conservative libertarian mindset, please feel free to join us there. And many thanks again to Kia and Masha for putting that together. And I just want to give a shout-out really quick, Declan, to Kia Heavey, because we were talking about graphic designers before, and Kia is phenomenal, and I have to say her rates are really good. She did a wonderful job for Shlomo Atiyah's forthcoming book, Steps to Salvation. She was a pleasure to work with. Also, you know, while I'm doing that, too, let me put a shout-out to my friend Carrie Lundy from Tennessee. Carrie did a cover for Reflections on the Ring, which is a book that you were gracious enough to read for me, that I wrote for someone back in November, and she did a great job with that. So, and she was also very reasonable. So there are people out there, authors, if you're looking for that, and certainly you can follow me at Daria Ann or at WriteStream on Twitter, Daria Ann DiGiovanni Author on Facebook. I'm also in the CLFA, and you can find me at Daria Ann DiGiovanni Facebook, and I am on LinkedIn, but you know what, Declan, I'm on LinkedIn and I post stuff there, but it's like I don't really interact with people there because it's very business-oriented, which is good. I mean, I'm not putting it down for that, but it's not as interactive unless you're part of a group on there. And, you know, I got enough groups going on here with Facebook, so I'm not really, but I am on there if you want to find me, Daria DiGiovanni. But please, you can go to my blog, dariadigiovanni.com. And also please visit WriteStreamRadio.com for a full rundown on all of our wonderful hosts and shows here on the network, because we've been really working hard to grow it. We have a WriteStream Radio Network page on Facebook as well. I try to create events every time I have a guest on and for all of our shows. And I'll tell you, Declan, it is a lot of work. I mean, juggling all these balls in the air sometimes is crazy, but I enjoy it, and hopefully it's helping people.
Definitely. Anyway, thank you for another enjoyable show.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on your book contract, and please, please keep us informed about Honor at Stake.
Definitely. I intend to.
All right, well, sounds good. Well, Declan, I'll see you on Facebook. Everyone else, please have a great week. Just as a programming note, next week I'm doing something completely different on WriteStream Tuesday. We're going to talk about something that affects not only writers, but really anybody that works at a computer all day long, and that is carpal tunnel syndrome. And I have a really wonderful guest, Dr. Tanya Howard. She is a chiropractor from Maryland and a holistic health practitioner, and she's just a real sparkly personality and a wealth of information. So she's going to be talking to us on ways to avoid carpal tunnel, and if you have it, to manage it or hopefully get rid of it. So please tune in next week at 1 p.m. for WriteStream Tuesday with Dr. Tanya. The next show up on the network will be Family Power Hour at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow night with Dr. Billy and family law attorney Sheena Benjamin Wise. And Lisa Tarvis and I will be co-hosting Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss this Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern, so look for details on that out in the social media world. And I'll see you back here for WriteStream Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern next week. Thanks for listening. Take care, everybody.